Welcome to the Dreamcatcher Podcast, a place where your dreams can find a voice. I'm your host, Celine Chenoy. Thank you to all of you who return every week to tune in to become a better version of yourself. Make sure you hit subscribe if you haven't already, and rate our show if you enjoyed this episode. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Dreamcatcher Podcast, a place where your dreams can find a voice. I'm your host, Celine Chenoy. Thank you to all of you who return every week to tune in to become a better version of yourself. Make sure you hit subscribe if you haven't already and rate our show if you enjoy this episode. Ikigai is a Japanese phenomenon that roughly translates to your reason for living. But in reality, it means so much more. It includes the small, everyday things as well as big goals and achievements. According to my guest, Ken Mogi, Ikigai is the path to success and happiness in your own life. He is here to illustrate what he means by this. Ken Mogi is a neuroscientist, writer, and broadcaster based in Tokyo. He has published over 30 papers on cognitive science and neuroscience, and over 100 books in Japan covering popular science, essay, criticism, and self-help. His books have sold close to 1 million copies. He is the author of Awakening Your Ikigai and The Way of Nagomi. During our conversation, Ken will speak about different facets of Ikigai and how each one plays out in Japanese culture. He'll also discuss the 5 pillars of Ikigai and how we can apply them to our everyday lives to create more meaning, harmony, joy, and prosperity. Hi, Ken. How are you doing today?
Very well. And thank you for having me, Celine.
Oh, yeah. It's such a pleasure to have you on the show. I want to start our conversation by talking about your book, Awakening Your Ikigai. It was an absolute delight to read. The stories, the principles, and the cultural practices that you describe in the book really opened my eyes to the heart of the Japanese people in a way nothing else has. So I just want to acknowledge that. And I also am curious, what was the experience of writing this book? What was it like for you?
Well, actually, it was my first full-length book in English, and so it was fun. It was an interesting challenge, and also it was in the process I had to kind of verbalize what was so natural for me or for Japanese people in general. So because Ikigai is something like the air in this country, so you don't actually stop and think about it quite often. So it was a really wonderful journey of soul searching, if you like, to, you know, write explicitly about what Ikigai is. So that was a great fun.
Yeah, and you did such an amazing job of it. I really felt like I was immersed in Japan. I could feel and smell and see everything. So it was I really, really loved reading it.
Thank you.
So let's talk about Ikigai. So you have an interesting definition of it. You describe it as small-scale, patient, mundane, and long-sighted. And I find this definition really powerful because it really speaks to an outlook that is lacking in modern society. So can you please expand on your definition of Ikigai?
Yeah, Sarah, I'm a great fan of your book, the picture of it.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
Actually, we share the same issue here, I think, because in this book, you write how the self-perceived value of a woman is defined by externally, you know, traded, you know, measures of beauty and so on. And I really feel empathy for that. I mean, you know, this is not about women. It's about all of us. You know, we are defined, increasingly defined by external measures like income, you know, meritocracy, and, you know, the school you went to and so on. So that is also in our country too. But ikigai is something different. I mean, ikigai is something coming from inside you. So, you know, it's something that is personal, something that is private, but something that you can pursue all your life. So I think, you know, your book and my book actually shares the same sensitivity about personal journeys. And I find that really interesting. And so I was really looking forward to this conversation here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for that. None of my guests has ever mentioned my book. So that definitely took me by surprise. So how is ikigai practiced in Japanese culture? You give a lot of examples in the book, but if you could give us two examples that really illustrate the true essence of ikigai, what would those be?
Okay, I would say one is probably the owner of a ramen noodle restaurant. You know, maybe you know what a ramen noodle is.
It's of course, yeah. It's delicious. And,
yeah, so I wrote also about kodawari, which is kind of a sticking to your principles and self-set goals, if you like, for what you make. So many ramen noodle restaurant owners in Japan, they have a certain, you know, taste that they look for and certain flavors that they would like to create in what they provide to the customer. And that does not actually, you know, reflect on the income that they receive. I mean, so in the US, for example, people always talk about revenues and how much money you make and so on. But in Japan, we do have that because we are living in a modern society. But at the same time, we have this totally different universe of private and personal objectives you set for your life. And that is ikigai, I think. So I think if you go to a Japanese ramen noodle restaurant, I think you have a bowl of ikigai, if you like, that you can have for your lunch.
And what are the ingredients of that?
Yeah. That's right. And other example, I think, of ikigai that we have here is perhaps the otaku culture. You heard about it? Otaku means geek in English. You know, anime and
manga, right? Yeah.
We call that we call these people otaku. So otaku. They would do cosplay.
It's famous everywhere.
Okay, so cosplay is Japanese English for costume playing or costume players. And they have this meeting called komike or comic market. And they go about this business of producing their own manga and, you know, producing their own costume inspired by anime characters. And they are actually not paid for that. I mean, they are not professional, you know, people, but they do something for their day job, like office workers and, you know, store merchants and so on. But they enjoy the business of playing otaku in anime and manga inspired genres so much. So that is their ikigai. So I think that is another very interesting example of ikigai that we have in this country. You are not, you know, measured up by the income that you get from these activities. It's the inner pressure that you get from these things, and you are respected for that. You know, the fans respect each other for what they do. So I think that's another really great example of ikigai.
So in the Western world, that would be kind of like your side hustle, something you do beside your day job.
Yeah, that's right. But that's the beauty of it. You know, this very wonderful anime maker, Hayao Miyazaki, who is known for works like My Neighbor Totoro and Spirited Away. He is a really respected anime maker. So anime making is, of course, his day job and what he does professionally. But I actually interviewed him for Japanese TV in my capacity as a broadcaster. I do neuroscience, but also I do some broadcasting here in this country. So I interviewed Hayao Miyazaki for NHK, which is a Japanese national broadcaster equivalent to BBC. And I could tell that for Hayao Miyazaki, the great anime film maker, it was his hobby. I mean, side hustle, if you like, in your town. So, you know, there's this continuum of, you know, activities from amateurish things to really professional things. And there's no difference in terms of ikigai. So that's the beauty of it. I'm sure Hayao Miyazaki is making all these wonderful anime films just for the pleasure of it. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't care about Academy Awards, which he got. you know, he doesn't, I mean, it's not important. I think that's the beauty of Japanese culture in terms of ikigai.
Right. And it's interesting that they don't feel the need to broadcast what they do. There's a sort of, I guess, modesty about the Japanese culture. And you actually say that, you know, to follow your ikigai, you don't have to blow your trumpet to be heard. Right. You can whisper sometimes to yourself, because that kind of harmonizes with society and that would reduce competition and comparison. And I thought that was quite insightful. So tell us about how ikigai can be expressed in a low-key way and why that's important.
I think because Japan has a long history, people have this perception that those people who have really special values do not necessarily become celebrities, if you like. For example, in Kyoto, the ancient capital of Japan, we have houses that have been, you know, doing tea ceremony, for example, for hundreds of years, but they do not advertise their wares. I mean, they are not TV celebrities, if you like, in the modern sense. So, you know, we do have these old traditions in which people do not advertise. They do not blow their trumpet, but we know they are of value. Actually, for example, about the imperial family, we actually don't know what they are up to in their daily lives. They do not broadcast themselves like the British royal family.
Yes.
British royals, yes, exactly.
Yeah, you know exactly what they're doing. Maybe they're just, maybe a couple of weeks in a year, they just go off the radar, but other days, you know what they're doing. Yeah. So that's interesting. So the Japanese imperial family are very private. They don't.
Yeah, but we know that they are doing something really special inside the imperial park in the heart of Tokyo. So we have these kind of sensitivity that in which we respect those people who we just whisper or who do not speak at all. And so we have all these expectations of value in these people. So I think that's probably different from the Western culture.
For sure. And what about celebrity culture? So if Ken Watanabe walks down the street in Tokyo, would he be mobbed or would people just be like, okay, there he is. So they wouldn't bother him? Sorry, that's the only Japanese celebrity I can think of right now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Personally, certainly they do not broadcast their personal net worth.
Yes.
And you know, related to your wonderful book here, I mean, glamour or excessive beauty is not part of Japanese celebrity culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, the expectations for a famous person in Japan is more subdued and more down to earth and compared to Western counterparts. So,
and that's also quite different from South Korea as well, right? Because they're your neighbors.
Yeah, that's right. We are neighbors.
Yes.
But Korean and Japanese pop cultures are somewhat different. So
I've noticed that.
Yeah, so we do not have to keep up with the Kardashians, you know, if you like. I mean, so we don't have that. You know, we do not have that kind of living up to expectations for a celebrity. So actually, I'm a kind of a celebrity myself. But look at my wealth.
You certainly are. Yeah, you're very accomplished.
Just a few thousand yen, which is, I don't know, $10 maybe. So I think that's a really interesting Japanese approach, if you like, to life. More subdued.
And not to flaunt your wealth and flaunt your status.
Just, yeah, that's right. So that's the formula for Ikigai, I think. And we are fine. I mean, we are not so stressed out. We are not under the constant pressure to broadcast ourselves. I mean, so as you wrote in your book, I was really amazed that when you're young, you had your problem with your self-image. Looking at you now, it's something that we don't expect. But you wrote that once you became attractive to other people, you had this constant pressure to, be like
to live up to the standards. Yes, and a lot of women can identify with my story because there is a constant pressure to look a certain way and be a certain way.
Yeah, so we have our share of that kind of pressure in our country. But I think it's more subdued. And so I think we have this, perception that everyone has his or her right to pursue his or her own ikigai. And, you don't really need to be glamorous in order to be popular. I think that's a common perception here. So I think that is something that the Western world could probably learn from.
Absolutely. So how does one start that journey of finding their ikigai? Where do they start? Like, what are some...
Actually, I put, for fun, I have put the five pillars of ikigai here.
The five pillars. Oh, that's very creative.
That's a famous Hokusai painting.
Okay.
So the first pillar is starting small.
Starting small.
And second pillar is releasing yourself. And third pillar is harmony and sustainability.
Yes.
And the fourth pillar is the joy of little things. And the fifth pillar is being in the here and now. So these are the five pillars that are described in my book. And if you're interested, you can look it up. But I think, starting small is very important. As a neuroscientist, by the way, I have a model of the brain because I study the brain. So I can...
Yeah, for those listening, Ken is holding up a kind of model of the brain right now.
Oh, yeah. Some people are
listening to this, yes.
Okay. So, yes. We have a model of the brain, and we have the so-called reward system in which dopamine is released to the prefrontal cortex so that neural circuits in your brain will be reinforced. That is something called reinforcement learning, and which is used by artificial intelligence systems today as well. And, so in this reinforcement loop, actually, starting small is a really wonderful idea because, you tend to aim at big goals, like, winning the Pulitzer Prize or, Academy Awards and so on.
Becoming an American Idol.
Yeah, that's right. So, but even if you aim for these big goals, the reality of the neural circuits is that you need to start small. Remember when you were a child, when you try to ride a bicycle, first you didn't succeed, but gradually you could, start to ride a bicycle and you get all these pleasures that you can get from these things. So starting small is one of the really important, ways to have your ikigai.
Mm-hmm.
And many people miss that because many people actually start big nowadays. So that's a huge problem, I think.
Yes.
And it's intimidating. It's intimidating because then you're like, oh my God, look at the, how can I do that? It's like, how much work will I have to put into it? It's, yeah, it's intimidating to, if your goal is too big, you have to break it down into smaller steps that is more achievable.
So if you look, if you have read the biography of Elon Musk, even Elon Musk starts small in his own way. I mean, when he starts Tesla, for example, Elon Musk sleeps in the factory. I mean, he sleeps in the factory and he works on all these parts and manufacturing processes one by one. Very hands-on approach. So when we think of Elon Musk, we tend to think of him as a kind of a really big entrepreneur. But in reality, he starts small. So I think that's the beauty of actually, you know, being a person who can, you know, pursue great goals, like going to Mars. Mm-hmm. Even going to Mars starts small.
Starts small.
Yeah, I think that's a really wonderful message from Ikigai.
Great.
Releasing yourself.
Yes.
You know, this is something that the Japanese people are really good at when they get to know each other very well. If you noticed, you know, of course, we are cautious. We are always polite. But once you get to know someone, you really have a true heart-to-heart. And so that is very important not to... so that you wouldn't stress yourself. In, you know, modern society, I think people are too busy keeping up appearances and pretending to be someone. So releasing yourself. I think that was your own journey, wasn't it, Serena? Releasing yourself.
Yeah. So what you're talking about is really being your authentic self.
That's right, that's right.
Okay. Yeah, how would you be able to express your ikigai if you're not true to yourself?
Yeah, and that actually is the only way to make your life harmonious and sustainable. So the third pillar is harmony and sustainability. And, you know, for a limited period of time, you might try to keep appearances and be successful in that. But you would be stressed out and you cannot be your natural self. So, for example, look at my hair. I mean, people who are listening cannot look at my hair, but I have been cutting my own hair for 20 years or so now, ever since I was doing postdoc in United Kingdom. So this is my hair. I cannot help it. So, you know, actually, maybe, Serena, you don't believe it, but when I go on TV programs, I go like this. I mean, so the hair make people, they are so upset because they cannot do anything about my hair.
But, but it's part of your personality. It's what makes you.
Part of my personality now.
Yeah.
But in the beginning, when I was a teenager, just like yourself, I had my issues with my hair, because I cannot do anything about it. It was so obstinate. So, but once you become your true self by releasing yourself, you can make your life sustainable. I think that's a really wonderful point. You know, but do you? Sammy, I have a personal question for you. So,
sure.
You are not obsessed with your appearances so much now?
Obsessed with appearances?
Your appearances, yeah.
With my appearance or other people's appearance?
Yeah, your appearance, your own appearance.
I don't make it part of my identity as much as I used to because I place more importance on other parts of my identity, like my skills and my ikigai. Yeah. So I don't focus on my appearance too much. I am aware of it because the whole world, like, people are visual and they're going to make judgments about you first based on how you look. I think it's important to find that balance of, okay, I have to take care of my external appearance, but not be so attached to it in a way that it can impact my self-worth and make me feel bad if someone doesn't like the way I look. Because if that happens, then you're going to have all kinds of insecurities. So this is the way I look. And if you don't like it, that's your problem. So just having that kind of attitude is important to cultivate. So yeah, it's about striking a balance, really.
Yeah, I totally agree. So
yeah,
I think it's in your journey, in your life, I think it's very important to be yourself and just let it go. And don't, you know, keep up appearances. That's the only way I think you can make a sustainable ikigai of your life. And which brings us to the fourth pillar, the joy of the two things. And, you know, I go for a run every morning and in the summer in Tokyo, because as a kid, I used to study butterflies scientifically. When I find a butterfly, I have my butterfly moment. I just love to watch them fly around, and it really gives me immense pleasure, you know, these butterfly moments. So that's the joy of little things. It's nothing special. I don't make money from it, but it's my life's joy, and that's my ikigai. So the question I have for you, Celine, is what is your joy of little things? I mean, what is your small joy?
What is my small joy? I'd say one of them is probably reading a good book.
Okay.
And drinking a cup of chai latte. It's my favorite drink.
Okay.
Yes.
Great. And so you don't get money from that, do you? I mean, drinking a chai latte.
No, I don't. I get pleasure from it.
Yeah, so... Yes. So I think this is something really important to keep your ikigai.
Yes.
You know.
Alive. And why is that? How was that connected to ikigai?
Because ikigai is a spectrum. You know, of course, I get great joys from doing things that matter socially. That is at the bigger spectrum of my ikigai. But on the other hand, I have my private joys, which is on the smaller side of my spectrum of ikigai. So you really need to have a portfolio, if you like, of ikigai in your life. That would make your life more robust and sustainable. And importantly, if your life doesn't go well, and you cannot get really great big ikigai in your life when your business doesn't go well or when you fail in your school and so on. If you have the joy of little things, that would support you through difficult periods of your life. So it's important to have these little joys because you never know. There could be sunny days, but there could be also rainy days. And when it rains, it's really great to have an umbrella of joy of little things. So I think that's a really important part of ikigai.
Yeah, I like that. So you're not putting all your eggs in one basket, so to speak, by taking that approach. Yeah,
that's right. And the fifth and I think the most profound pillar of ikigai is being in the here and now.
Mm.
Now, because this is, I think, life's greatest secret to be in the here and now. You know, I really admire the Czech bomb US psychologist, Csikszentmihalyi, who is no longer with us, sadly. He researched the flow state in psychology. And when you are in the flow, you forget the passage of time, but you get the maximum performance. So I have interviewed in my capacity as a broadcaster many Olympians and many Olympic gold medalists here in this country. And they say that when they are successful in the competition, they are in the here and now. They have the flow, well, they are in the zone. So actually, this is really amazing. I mean, when they win the gold medal in the Olympics, they actually are not aware that they are competing. I mean, you start, you run, and it's over. And you realize that you have been in a competition. That's so amazing.
They're completely in the zone. They don't even think about what's going to happen.
That's right. They are not even thinking that they are in the Olympics final. So we can do this every day. I mean, even if you cannot do it at the level of these Olympians, in your life, when you are working, I think it's always possible to be in the here and now so that you forget what you're doing. You forget the passage of time. And most importantly, you don't care whether it's successful or not. Actually, paradoxically, forgetting to care about your success is the most certain way to succeed, So that's, yeah. I think, you agree?
I totally agree. And there's a story that's related to this concept that you talk about. It's actually an anecdote you share about your conversation with a famous court musician in the Gagaku tradition. I hope I'm saying it right.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
And his name is Hideki Togi. And I just absolutely love the story. He talked about playing music in the Japanese Imperial Palace, even though there was no audience.
Yeah, that's right.
So
this is amazing.
So this speaks to the idea of being in the flow, enjoying what you're doing, and not really being worried about, if you're going to get praise for it or if there's other people listening to you. So tell us more about that.
Yeah, I mean, this is the gem that I got from a radio show that I did. Hideki Togi is a very famous court musician, and he comes from traditional family. And he played music for the emperor and empress in the imperial palace. So, typically these people would be present. But, actually these court musicians, they played late into the night. So at first, the emperor and empress would be present, but gradually these people would, retire. Even after the emperor retires, the court musicians keep playing. And Hideki told me that they feel that the spirit of the past emperors are coming down from the heaven and share a moment of joy with them and go back to where they were. And, they play on without any audience, any living human audience. So that, he said, was the very important spirit of royal imperial music in Japan. And what is astonishing was that he didn't broadcast it. He didn't, think it was significant. Actually, he mentioned that during our small talks in the interview, that we were doing in a radio station. So he didn't think that it was a very significant fact of the job that he did. But I was awestruck. I mean, I was so moved by what he said. And that was something that was really implicit in the ikigai of the court musicians in the Imperial Palace, and something that the modern day humans probably have forgotten. Because, we are so attention greedy, in the so-called attention economy. We publish our videos and, TikTok. And if nobody's watching, we feel so sad. But these court musicians in the Imperial Palace in the heart of Tokyo, they do not care. as long as they enjoy it.
Yeah. So why do you think they don't care? What is it that they're able to get from that experience that makes them not need that external validation?
I think the fact that they are playing a beautiful music and the fact that they are enjoying themselves, I think is sufficient. The presence of the audience was not important. Actually, I had the same feeling when Bob Dylan came to Japan last year. I went to a concert and he played his music. That was great, you know, Bob Dylan. I mean, but you know, also we hugely enjoyed it. But there was this feeling that he didn't really care if there was an audience or not. I mean,
yeah,
he just played his music.
Yeah.
And you know, this was really impressive. When the concert was over, of course we applauded, but Bob Dylan stood in the center of the stage, just like this. You know, yeah. He didn't wave or anything, nod or anything. He just stood there and went out of the stage. And that was it. I mean, there was no reappearance. Bob Dylan was just being himself. I think Bob Dylan was probably like the court musicians in the Japanese Imperial Palace, I mean, at that moment. So in your words, I mean, I think he didn't need any acknowledgement or, you know, praise from other people.
Right. So
yeah, because he knew he was playing well and he was singing well.
So I think, yeah. I think the first step is to find something that you're so passionate about
that's right.
You can derive so much pleasure from just doing it, and because that would be the reward itself.
I think so. And I think life is like that, isn't it? I mean, when we are doing things in our life, sometimes we get recognition, but most of the time we do it alone. I mean, when you are working on your book or when you are doing things, nobody is watching you, right? And that's life. So I think this spirit of being in the here and now goes deep down to what we humans are. I mean, in the modern society, we are so attention, you know, greedy and seeking always for recognition. I am that kind of person, part of myself. But at the same time, I'm doing things entirely alone most of the time. And when I'm doing that, if I have an inner sense of ikigai, I can get a deep satisfaction from what I'm doing anyway. And paradoxically, if you are living a life like that, people do recognize your work eventually. So I think that's one of the most wonderful wisdoms that you can get from, you know, your life. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I absolutely. And I'm thinking of the famous sushi maker that you write about. I forget his name, but he himself, he came from a very like a humble background. And he, because of his pure passion for making sushi, he was able to eventually gain attention. And I believe he has one of the most famous sushi eateries in Japan. Right?
That's right. Jiro Ono is the owner of Sukiyabashi Jiro, where President Obama went when he came to Japan for a state visit. And, you know, you've been to a Japanese sushi restaurant, haven't you?
I have in Japan. Yes, I have.
Okay, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, in Kyoto.
What we should appreciate is that the moment you sit at the counter of a really great sushi restaurant in Japan, actually 99% of the job has been done. You know, selecting the fish, preparing the fish, and sometimes the sushi chefs let them be for a certain period of time so that the sushi fish meat would mature and umami would come out of them. I mean, so when you sit at the sushi counter, you watch in amazement the really, really wonderful movement of the sushi chef, you know, putting, you know, sushi together and putting it in front of you. And that's what you see. But before that, 99% of a sushi chef has already been done. So nobody acknowledged that. You know, only those people who are in the know probably might imagine what kind of lengths these sushi chefs have gone, but they do it in entirely in the dark. So that is the life of a sushi chef. So that is when I think you have this philosophy of ikigai where you get inner satisfaction even if nobody's watching. So
yeah, and it does it also speak to kadabri and the sense of trying to really raise our standards and really pay attention to the small details. That also plays a big part in that, right?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. The way it is that, for example, if you go to a sushi restaurant, most of the customers do not notice the difference anyway. I mean, you know, it's so nuanced. And, you know, if you eat a tuna fish, for example, you cannot really differentiate between all these detailed tastes and flavors that could come your way. But the sushi chef know that. So when you talk with a sushi chef, when you really engage them, they can tell you amazing stories about how they go about choosing the fish and how they prepare sushi and how they can get the very finest fish only once or twice a year. So that's the world that they live in. But we as casual customers do not notice that. So kodawari is when you have a really high standard that you can satisfy only through really arduous endeavors. But most customers do not notice that. So it's totally, you know, it has nothing to do with the so-called market. You know, in the market, people trade, and we as consumers buy things that we think are great. But, you know, these people with kodawari are operating at a level that most of us don't even notice. But that, I think, is a definition of a true professional. In any profession, actually, in showbiz, entertainment, bookmaking. I really liked your prose, by the way. I liked your writing.
Thank you.
I liked your writing.
Thank you. I think I've gotten a lot better since then. That was my writing in 2017.
Oh, okay.
So
okay. I watch out.
I'm also guided by kodawari, and I have to keep raising the bar.
I did notice that.
Yeah, but thank you for saying that.
So you know these things make our day, don't they? I mean, I have my own kodawari, and I think we should really respect each other's kodawari, even if it's not that easy to appreciate that.
Absolutely. Well, Ken, this has been such an insightful conversation. I really want to thank you for sharing your inspirational message and your wisdom with us today. I'm sure everyone will gain so much from this conversation.
Thank you for having me, Celine. And I really enjoyed every second of it.
So did I. So I just want to let our listeners know, if you're interested in learning more about Ken's book, Awakening Your Ikigai, How the Japanese Wake Up to Joy and Purpose Every Day, you can find that information and you can purchase a copy in all major bookstores.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed what you just heard, please subscribe to my podcast and feel free to share it with your friends and family. Take care and speak soon.